Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Harriet Samuels, Associate Director of the AHRC-funded Centre for Law, Gender and Sexuality here at the University of Westminster in London. I'm delighted to introduce the first in our series of conversations. The aim of the conversation series is to exchange ideas between policymakers, academics, non-government organisations and activists. My hope is that it will increase understanding of the various fields of work and study. It's an opportunity for everyone to participate, explore and exchange ideas, information and experiences. Today's conversation focuses on gender, human rights and international law. The conversation will be around 50 minutes of discussion between the participants, followed by 10 minutes for questions from our small invited audience of graduate students and interns. I'd like now to give a very warm welcome to our participants, Professor Hilary Charlesworth from the Australian National University, who's Professor of Human Rights and International Law, and Professor and Director of the Centre for International Governance and Justice in Regulatory Institutions Networks. So welcome. And Geeta Sargal from the Gender Unit of Amnesty International, International Secretariat, and Catherine Lockett from Womankind. The session will be facilitated by Dr. Zoe Pearson, lecturer from the University of Kiel, who lectures in international law. So I'll turn over to Zoe now.
Great, thanks very much, Harriet. Just to get things started then, by way of general introduction for everybody, would you three be able to introduce yourself, saying something about your organisation and the sort of work that you do in your position? We'd also be very grateful if you could say something about what attracted you to the area of policy activism or research in that work.
I'm Geeta Sargal. I'm head of the gender unit at Amnesty International's International Secretariat, which means that I work on all policy issues concerning gender. Which is often interpreted as women's rights, women's human rights, but of course it's a wider brief than that. And I was attracted into this area of work through a rather strange route, which was that I worked for most of my life as a freelance filmmaker and writer who worked on many issues that are pertinent to the issues I work on at Amnesty International. I did investigative films on war crimes. I worked on the issue of women who kill their husbands and the Kiranjeet Ahluwalia case, which went into case law in Britain, and on many other issues concerning multiculturalism, fundamentalism, race and gender, all of which were pertinent to Amnesty International's work and wider work on women and conflict.
Well, Womankind works with about 32 partners in 14 countries worldwide, and we work with a model of working through local women's organisations. I manage our programmes in Afghanistan and India. I suppose my background is mainly working with local organisations overseas in post-conflict and transitional states such as Afghanistan, Nepal, Kyrgyzstan and Russia. And I think one of the most powerful things is that the contribution that local civil society does play to holding governments accountable, to things like security sector reform and legal reform, and really just showing the very active role that women can play in changing their situation. So that's really my background and from where I come from. And I've got particular interest in how gender issues play into violence, how it plays into militarisation, and generally how it kind of manifests in the causes of violent conflict, as well as the kind of continuation of violence from a household to a community, to a state, to a symbolic, to a armed conflict level. So that's my background.
Great, thank you, Hilary.
So I'm Hilary Charlesworth. I'm really an academic, so I'm the token academic in this conversation here. And I'm sort of very conscious that, I suppose as a feminist, you probably are inevitably an activist, but that's the only sense in which I count myself an activist, because I've really been in the academy now for actually for 20 years, I realise, so it's quite a long time. But I really trained as an international lawyer, and for a long time, and it was when I was doing graduate work in the United States that I first encountered feminist theories as applied to law, and that was quite a revelation to me because doing law in Australia, I did a very traditional black letter law degree, and when I was, as I say, at graduate school in the US, this was in the 80s when feminist ideas about law were really just beginning to permeate in the academy. And for quite a long time, I actually thought that these feminist ideas, they really interested me, they were fascinating. But I actually thought they had no application to international law. I thought, well, international law is all about states, so I couldn't imagine. I saw them as two completely separate interests. And it was really meeting Christine Chinkin, my colleague who's now at the LSE, we met at a conference about 20 years ago, and we both had found, we were both international lawyers and we both had interest in feminist theory, and we both would say, what a shame feminist theory has nothing to say to international law. And then one time we, really just to annoy our male colleagues, the international lawyers, we just decided, we had no idea what we were going to say, but with another colleague, Shelley Wright, we just decided we, at the annual international law conference in Australia, we'd offer a paper on feminist approaches to international law, and then we assumed they'd say no, you can't possibly give that paper, that's not acceptable, but they said yes, that sounds really interesting, go ahead. And we then finally had to think about what we were going to say. So for me, in a way, coming into this was really from quite an academic perspective, and I'm very conscious, that's why I'm looking forward to the conversation, I'm very conscious that my ideas are really not born of a lot of local knowledge, although the particular project I'm working on now, which is on peace building and peacekeeping, I have visited countries in the Pacific and Asian region near Australia, but these are, again, they're academic sort of visits, they're not actually working in these countries, so my knowledge of them is often very thin, but that's my background.
Great, well thank you all. It's really great to be able to draw on such a lot of experience, and I'm sure this conversation is going to go wonderfully. I've grouped the sorts of questions that we wanted to explore today into three rough areas. Firstly, thinking about international law and gender, the connections there. Secondly, thinking about the connection between local experience and global issues. And thirdly, thinking more, reflecting on more closely the respective and perhaps complementary roles and responsibilities of academics and activist practitioners, policymakers. So just to start off then the conversation around the first theme of international law and gender. The first question we'd be interested to hear your views on is from your varied perspectives. How do you think international law in general and peacekeeping missions and peace agreements in particular address gender issues? So that's the first question, and as part of that, I suppose, what are the problems or what are the advantages gained of using international law or international human rights law in particular to address gender issues? Catherine,
well, generally, I think that the international law and the frameworks that are in place, you know, if you're looking at the Convention for Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, or UN Security Council Resolution 1325, the Rome Statute, I think generally speaking, they provide a very strong framework, and that particularly local organisations do use them to for their approaches at a national level and also as kind of an advocacy tool to implement it into international legislation and in post-conflict settlements as well as new constitutions and that kind of thing. But I think the main problem is the implementation is actually very, very poor, whether or not that's whether countries sign up to it, whether or not there is actually integration at a national level in terms of what the governments are doing, and also whether or not they put the resources behind these instruments to make them work. I mean, from our experience, we find that women are actually often very, very sidelined in peace agreements. If you look at, for example, one of our partners, Save Somali Women and Children, they, when they were looking at the Somalian peace process, women were completely excluded. It was completely based on a kind of clan system, and there was 5 clans for which women weren't involved, and so the women activists got together and formed a 6th clan whereby they could be represented at the peace agreement. So kind of cross, kind of not partisan, basically they all got together and found women as their clan, and that meant that they could actually get involved in the peace agreements. But that obviously was quite a struggle. And I think one of the other major issues when you're looking at peace agreements is that transitional justice mechanisms often fail to deal with kind of issues of gender equality or structural inequality, or really looking at some of those issues. And also obviously issues of impunity and justice, particularly if you're looking at human rights abuses that have happened during a conflict. I would say that some of the really weak areas.
I think that's right. I mean, I agree completely with you about implementation. As we know, and as you very eloquently demonstrated yesterday, Hilary, that there is very little implementation, even of agreed settlements. And I think the exclusion of women from the peace, the formal peace negotiations, is almost universal, alongside movements in many, many countries across the world, where women have actually been part of the process that led to the peace negotiation. So I think there is something we haven't quite got to about women and peace. I don't think it's biological, but I think there are movements, there clearly are movements all over the world where women have made very strategic demands and very creative methods, as Catherine just said, of getting themselves noticed in a peace process, but largely they failed. But I think the impunity issue is another key issue, and of course it's a strong concern of Amnesty in holding people accountable for human rights violations that take place during the conflict, because quite often peace agreements are founded on various forms of immunity agreements that basically permit perpetrators to go free. And in some cases, we find, some of our researchers would say, that our insistence on impunity doesn't chime with the debates that are happening on the ground. You know, when the peace process is going on, people say, well, we just want peace. And we're talking about impunity, which raises all these nasty questions about, you know, should an international court be set up? Are they now going to be called, you know, hauled before the International Criminal Court? Who's going to deal with the perpetrators, when actually the perpetrators are part of one of the negotiating parties? And typically, of course, perpetrators exist on all sides. So every party has perpetrators. The other thing I think is, and I think this is one of the problems with implementation, is that in fact the issue of violations during the conflict is still not clearly recognized. I think everywhere rape is a metaphor for, you know, what happens to women in conflict, rape becomes used as a kind of metaphorical statement about harm to the community in conflict. But actual rapes of actual women are still grossly underreported. Many of our researchers have found that rape as a crime in so-called peacetime is seen not as a crime against adult women, because the adult woman must have had some agency, must have been, is thought generally to have been involved in some fashion, not very different from our own courts conducting rape trials, you know, in Britain, for instance, where there's an abysmal rate of conviction. But the issue of rape as a crime is virtually only recognized in some countries as happening to children. I mean, in other words, causing outrage within the community as a crime. It's much more recognized among children than it is to adults. So I think that the issue of what happens to people in conflict is still not well recognized. And as you said, Hilary, yesterday, the issue that many of the arguments around it, particularly women's human rights, trying to press women's claims in conflict, have perhaps inadvertently set up, as you said, a kind of forum of competing vulnerabilities. I think that's true. But I think with our experience at Amnesty International, as many of you may know, Amnesty came quite late to the table in terms of actually addressing women's human rights. It has sporadically addressed them, of course, in various ways. But as you said, precisely because international law was defined as being the business of relations of, between states, or the business of international human rights law being the business of states' relationships to individuals and restraining states' actions that might harm individuals. You know, actions that were committed by individuals who weren't states or groups that weren't states against other, either individuals against other individuals, husbands against wives, or groups like corporate groups or religious bodies or other social orders against individuals were not recognized as the business of international human rights. So I think that those issues, although the intellectual battle may have been won, I think the issues of accountability and the issues of how to research and monitor and make demands around these things are still far from solved, even though we've made great advances in many of these areas.
I suppose I'm going to present a, this just represents the academic perhaps distance in a way. I feel in a lot of ways that the battle hasn't been won from an intellectual perspective in international law. What I've observed over the last, say, 20 years since I've been an academic is that when the first sort of writings occurred about how could issues of gender and sex be absorbed in international law, there was at first great resistance, people just saying, well, that's ridiculous, never heard of that, and that's just crazy, and just go away. And I remember my colleague Christine Chinkin was told by a senior international lawyer that she should leave off any feminist articles on her CV when she applied for promotion, because he thought that would straight away mean that she didn't look very serious. So that was the first wave of sort of just don't even go there. Then what seems to have happened, I'm now speaking very broadly, that there has been an absorption of the language of gender and sex into international law. And so, you know, there is the language in the ICC statute, as you pointed out, and Resolution 1325. But so there's been this acceptance of the language, but I think the battle, the reason I would say I don't think the battle's been won, in that I think it's a very, very superficial acceptance of the language, so that there are still huge battles to be fought. You just have to look at what, for example, the human rights treaty bodies are doing. If you look at their general comments and some of the cases brought under the various optional protocols and individual complaints, to see that depending on the treaty body, you get some quite extraordinary statements made. And even though the human rights treaty bodies, I think 3 or 4 years ago, all adopted a resolution saying they were going to do gender mainstreaming, they seem to, in their questioning of countries when they appear before them, to have reduced that to simply saying how many women are in your judiciary or in your armed forces, and then they sort of do a big tick, oh, we've done the gender question. So I actually feel from an academic perspective that the there's been a superficial acceptance of the language, but it's really been put to one side. And that just at least in theoretical writings in international law, there's been almost no take-up of feminist ideas at all. So that among people who write in the theory of international law, you find feminists talking about these issues, but they're never taken up by, say, people in the critical international theory. I once asked... one of the best known of the, I suppose I shouldn't say his name, I'm going to tell the story about him, one of the best known of the critical international theorists, why he could write a book without any reference to feminist theory. And he said, well, my library didn't have any feminist books in it.
Including yours?
Well, I feel like saying, well, what about interlibrary loan or something like that? And, but he just sort of said that as though that was the answer. Oh, yes, I didn't get around to them because they weren't in my library. So, I feel that there's still quite a long way to go, and it's. I think there's also, again, I'm only speaking from an academic perspective, but there is quite a marginalisation of many of the ideas. So all the serious international lawyers go on and keep on talking in fairly black-letter ways, and I think so. I still see there's lots and lots of work to be done. But just to interact with one of the points that both of you raised, the issue of. Impunity. I was going to say it's, and this perhaps bears on other parts of our conversation, but I've been struck by quite different attitudes towards this. Again, I'm just speaking of the Pacific. So in Timor-Leste, in East Timor, the issue of impunity has been a very big issue for women's groups. And they have felt very, very frustrated that there hasn't been a proper system of accountability for the really massive crimes that were committed, both by the Indonesians during their very long occupation, 24 years, and at the period of the vote in 99 and afterwards. And the rate of domestic violence in East Timor is completely appalling. But they feel particularly some of the really massive crimes haven't been dealt with. And the UN did establish a special panel, but they basically acquitted everybody there. And there's quite a different attitude there, so it's a major issue there. In Bougainville, by contrast, there's Bougainville, the effectively an amnesty has been given for all crimes committed during the Troubles there. And the Bougainvillians say, well, what we are doing is reconciliation ceremonies, traditional reconciliation ceremonies. And I was very struck by speaking to some women there. Well, what did they feel about that? And some, there was quite a split. Some of the women felt, this isn't enough, and we really want something more formal for accountability. But a large number of women were very sceptical about that and said, look, we would prefer to have these traditional reconciliation ceremonies. This is the way that our culture has set out for these. So it's just interesting that there's impunity. I don't know if that's your experience at all, Catherine and Geeta, whether in different societies, different attitudes to the issue of impunity.
I think one of the most difficult things is that women are quite often silenced in general about some of their experiences, and particularly if you look at some of the cultures, you know, for example, in Afghanistan, where, you know, it is totally cultural taboo, for example, and you just don't talk about sexual violence. In fact, if a woman goes to a court and says she's been raped, she herself actually risks being imprisoned for crimes of zina or sex outside marriage. So I think particularly when you've got mechanisms of customary law as opposed to codified laws that are really most prominent, particularly in some of the areas, I think it's very, very risky for women to speak up about some of these issues. And I also think a lot of women are silenced because of the kind of cultural taboos around the situation. So there's kind of that element, there is the cultural element, there's the legal element, and then there's also the fact that a lot of these women are living very, very close sometimes to the perpetrators. They're living next door, or for example, if it was, for example, the army or the state, some of these people remain in power and living in very, very close proximity. And I think that's very problematic as well, because in that sense, people sometimes try and contain the violence. So I think in terms of the kind of transitional justice mechanism, it's very tricky. And particularly when the services are not in place, for example, you know, if the counselling services or if some of the support services aren't in place for people to kind of discuss and to come to terms with some of these experiences and to get the, you know, the basic support that they need, particularly when they risk perhaps being, you know, shunned by their communities or by their families, and there's nothing there to kind of pick them up and to help them and support them in rehabilitating or starting a new life. I think it's very, very difficult, and I think that really contributes actually some of these processes. And how, I mean, it's very dangerous in some ways because it means that the whole experience tends to be kind of missing from the history books, it's missing from the cultural archive almost, and I think that's why some of these things tend to get overlooked, because people don't necessarily even want to speak up about their own experiences. And it's only when you take a kind of very, very sensitive approach to finding out some of this information and ensure that the services are there. You know, they often say that women never want to talk about themselves. They'll perhaps talk about what happened to their neighbours, or they'll talk about what happened to their friends. And you kind of have to be quite sensitive to this when you're collecting the information. And again, that's a lot about the capacity of the organisations on the ground to collect that kind of information. So I think there's some real kind of practical elements of that.
I think the battle around impunity, I think the Comfort Women is, of course, the classic case where women came out years and years, decades after the events had happened in Japan, where they were held by the Japanese military and forced to work in forced prostitution. I think the term sexual slavery went into international language through the Comfort Women cases, but they came out many years afterwards. That wasn't accidental. I think there's a difference between women saying proactively that they would want some kind of traditional way of reconciling the communities to the kind of silencing that you're talking about. I think those are two different things. I think one is the ability of women to access any form of justice, whether they would want to or not, or the immense risk, you know, of death, basically, if they try to access it. And that certainly, Amnesty has experienced that in Afghanistan, but in other areas. But we find, for instance, in Bangladesh now, there's a very, very strong demand for investigation of the war crimes committed in 1971 at the formation of Bangladesh, where the Pakistan Army, it was then East Pakistan, but the West Pakistan Army occupied East Pakistan and committed huge violations, including mass rape. And although the history of that struggle has been documented, a lot of the issue of rape rather went underground. I mean, it was very well documented at the time. It was very, very well known at the time, just as the rape in Yugoslavia was and Rwanda was at the times of the conflicts there. But it went completely underground in terms of individual women testifying to it. But it is beginning to rise now, many, many years after the conflict, and in a period where people also feel threatened by the rise of fundamentalist forces in Bangladesh, who were collaborators of the Pakistan Army at the time, at 71. So they see a link between human rights violations that are being committed at the moment, and on a whole range of issues, from demands for blasphemy laws, attacks on religious minorities, Hindus and Muslim sects that are not recognized as Muslims, attacks on women, boycotts on women being organized by groups against development organizations that are working with women. They see a link between, and in fact, of course, typically it was the feminists who raised that link between the modern manifestations of fundamentalism and the human rights violations that occurred in 1971, whereas a lot of the sort of other progressive movements, largely male-led, were in fact quite obsessed with 71 because it's a founding moment of Bangladesh history, and many of them were involved with struggles around what they see as the liberation of Bangladesh and so on. So they wanted to document the violations then, but not necessarily see the linkages between the two. So I think there, you know, there are different attitudes in different places, but in fact we find that bringing in the issue of domestic violence now, which Amnesty's, for instance, worked on in Burundi and Sierra Leone and other places, looking at post-conflict situations and looking at continuing violence within post-conflict situations, really reframes impunity in a different way, because it becomes obvious that if you don't, at least it's foundational to our thinking in Amnesty, and I think it chimes very well actually with local groups. I don't feel that we're speaking at odds. This speaks to the, you know, issues between the local and global. That if the issues of violence in the family and violence in the community are not dealt with, then that links with the running sore of not really having come to terms with violence in the past. And Amnesty, for instance, has produced a manual on Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. I think we were at first rather wary of what they might do, but I think we now see them as a very useful way of treading that line between, you know, immediately giving in, you know, some kind of making an agreement that guaranteed immunity on the one hand, and getting the historical record on the table. And certainly Sierra Leone, for instance, women mobilized massively. There was a coalition of women working on human rights defense work around conflict issues. They mobilized women who had faced violations in the conflict to come up and speak. I think a lot of women have felt there wasn't much result from that, but I'm not sure that they regret having spoken at the time in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And certainly we've been pressing for the recommendations that were adopted by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, many of which were drawn up precisely by these coalitions of women activists, to be taken into account and to be, you know, worked on by the government. And of course there is a massive lack of political will, both by governments and by donors, to do this work.
I think you're right, Geeta. I mean, some of our partners in Peru, because that was, again, like the Sierra Leone Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that had like quite a good gender focus. It did look at the gender violence. And our partner, Dimas, there is able to take some of these findings and then use them at a local level to keep kind of lobbying the government to go through on their the promises that were made there. So I think they can be quite powerful tools.
And they may lead, in some cases, to court cases as well. I mean, you know, Amnesty would always argue that we shouldn't, they shouldn't lead to immunity agreements and so on. But they are a useful way of setting out a historical account, you know, which both sides, or the various sides, because I think there aren't two sides in these conflicts, and it's very clear that, you know, women are often not on a side. Well, they may be engaged on both sides, but they're quite often civilians caught in the middle of them. They may be engaged as participants and actors, even as combatants, or they may be engaged in the conflict as victims, and quite often victims from all the different parties. So it is important to create that record, and but also to look at the business of holding people to account once that record has been created.
I think one has to be very careful how they're actually designed, because there's quite a literature now about the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission from a feminist perspective, quite critical of it, and the way that women were silenced through it. And it's clear that it depends very, very much on the format. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in East Timor, which was very, very careful about, I mean, it published this sort of massive report, was it 2 years ago now, with extraordinary detail. And that seemed to have taken a lot of care to actually get to hear women's voices. But then the big issue is actually, what do you do with this amazing report? It's documented an extraordinary story, and that will stand for all time as an amazing historical record. But women in East Timor are now saying, well, you've got the record, and where are you going from here? Which is remains an issue.
I think some of this always comes back to the fact that, you know, resources need to be there and the political will needs to be there to take some of these recommendations forward, whether that is international legislation, whether that's findings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I think that issue of resources is in some ways where, you know, academics and activists can really kind of help the women on the ground in making sure that the international donors and the policy makers are ensured that they kind of put their money where their mouth is, if you see what I mean, in that sense.
I think one of the other problems, though, that hasn't been identified much, and I think many of the women who work precisely using 1325 would very much agree with the critique that you made of it, because it is from women who work on these issues on the ground that I've heard very powerful critiques of the lack of enforceability of 1325. Of course, it's almost a wonder that it happened at all. I mean, the UN Security Council is not known as a great feminist body, and precisely because it not only deals with the business of relations between states, but you know, the international issues of international security between states. And I agree with you, Hilary. I mean, when I say the intellectual battles won, I think what I meant was that we have enough foundation to go ahead if we wanted to. And I think you've helped to create that foundation in international human rights law, but it is still very marginalized. And not only is it marginalized, in fact, not in the academic field, as you said, I think some of the developments that we've had to deal with in human rights, the attacks on human rights, have bizarrely, I think, led to the marginalization of women's human rights precisely in order to defend the human rights framework. I think some people have constructed the defense of the human rights framework as reducing it to what they see as its most core elements, for instance, the standard on torture, against a very clear attack, as we know, launched in the context of the war on terror on the torture standard. It seems slightly mysterious to me that extending the issue of torture to women and different circumstances in which women may face acts that amount to torture, creating a complete prohibition on all those acts in international law would seem to me to make the standard stronger rather than weaker, you know, so that you can't use I was out of uniform and I was overcome by my urges sort of argument for somebody committing rape if he's a state agent, so that you can't use an argument that this is a private act, not a public act. You can't use an argument that this is a bad apple, you know, rather than an act of state. I mean, I think reducing the excuses for these things would strengthen the standard, but most people perceive that if the standard should only be applied in limited circumstances, and that's the way to maintain what it is. And I think that's been a major setback, which I think that some of the special rapporteurs and so on are now trying to address that perception.
There is, it's an interesting point, and I think the, you know, in the post 9/11 sort of era, when this has changed fundamentally the sort of debates that you have about human rights, and there is a sense, I think, from the human rights community, look, we're out there battling against this big wave of overcoming even some very basic rights, you know, freedom of speech, prohibition on torture. There is, I certainly observe this in Australia in the human rights activist community. They sort of say that we're flat out trying to ensure that we hold the government accountable on these issues, and more or less don't, please don't muddy the waters a bit. You know, this is your women's human rights issues have had their day in the sun, and now we've got to really focus on some of these very, very basic things. This is, it's sort of quite, it's not said as crudely as I've put it there, I've rather extrapolated from that, but certainly something that I've noticed very strongly, as I say, particularly in the Australian context, when Amnesty, for example, or a number of the major groups are very focused on dealing with draconian laws and things like that, and put a lot of energy into that. And I think then campaigns about women tend to be seen, look, this isn't the front line. We're really battling this much larger issue. So it's I think certainly in many ways that change in atmosphere has been very problematic for women and protection of their rights.
And I think it's also meant, I mean, we do now do much more work on non-state actor violence than we did at one time, and a lot of that has been done through the Stop Violence Against Women campaign, but it's also been done on holding armed groups accountable wherever we can. So, for instance, we've addressed Maoist forces in Nepal on their violations and, you know, reminded them of their obligations not to attack civilians under Common Article 3 and so on. And we've done that with the LTT and a number of other armed groups, but we tend to be able to deal with the armed group issue only when they control territory and where they're sort of semi-state-like entity. And therefore, you know, we can address recommendations to them, we can research their violations. And I think what we have begun to do a little bit, for instance, in a report marking the 5th anniversary of the Iraq conflict, was to look at the effects from all sides. We'd done it earlier on a report on Iraq around 2005, which looked at both the legal framework and discrimination in law under Saddam, as well as attacks on civilians and, for instance, attacks on Kurds in various, in Halabja and various places. But also then looked at the violations by the occupation forces as they were at that time, and also looked at some of the attacks of armed groups. And we did that again in just marking the 5th anniversary. So, and noted, which perhaps we wouldn't have done a few years ago, that some of the threats to women's rights were also then in a situation where you have communities being driven apart by sectarian violence, the threat really devolves right into the family, where people who come from, and that's very common in Iraq, there are many, many families who come from, say, both Shia and Sunni marriages, where women are being pressurized, and sometimes men are being pressurized to divorce because they're not safe as a couple, and they have to get out of, you know, they can't live in each other's neighborhoods and so on anymore. So that analysis is beginning to creep in, but I think we're still not seeing the level and types of threat, and again, because it's massively underreported, so it's very, very hard to pin down those kind of reports of what's actually happening to women and men in the conflicts by armed group violence. Obviously, I mean, you might note that a car bomb has gone off, but as you know from your work in Afghanistan, I mean, the Taliban activities are not just bombs in public places. I mean, that's one set of activities, as is happening in Iraq as well. But there are a whole lot of other activities threatening women in public spaces, the threats, you know, dress code threats, which we have reported also in many, many non-Muslim contexts. Some people assume that this is something to do with Islam, but we find it's something very much to do with the ways in which armed groups want to control not just territory, but exercise social control over groups, women and men, and particularly people who are seen not to be to be seen in some way not to be upholding what they see as the normative order. So gay men, women who are suspected or accused of prostitution, people who are living with HIV or suspected of being driven out of their towns or killed in Colombia. They've been attacked for what they wear. Men have had earrings pulled off. They've been told to cut their hair. Women have been, you know, told to cover their midriffs. We very recently had attacks by militias in the DRC, who I think are associated with Christian evangelical groups, on women, forcing them, attacking them for wearing trousers in public spaces and cutting them off if they're in trousers. So, you know, these kinds of issues come up again and again, and I think we're beginning to understand a bit about how to report them, but I think there's still the range and type of attack on, and particularly the ways in which women are controlled is still something that we're struggling both to understand ourselves as an organization, but also to get into the treaty body framework and, you know, into the work of the special rapporteurs and so on.
I think you've touched on a really important point there, Geeta, and I think a lot of the women in these countries are very much struggling with some of the more kind of cultural laws and this kind of whole debate around customary customs and traditions and what's acceptable and what isn't. And I think some of the stronger ways of doing that is when people kind of take on some of these arguments and kind of use them to advocate for their own rights. I mean, some of our partners in Afghanistan, for example, do a lot of women's rights in Islam training for the women there, and they find that's one of the most kind of empowering things for them, because it means that when they go back into their households and when they go back into their communities, you know, that they know their rights under Islam. So they'll take a kind of international framework for it and know that, you know, women are equal. They'll find justification from that, from the Quran and all the things that that kind of says, and use this as well to lobby for kind of legal change. And I think that's very, very powerful. Some of our other partners did it kind of Pan-African work, looking at the problem of female genital mutilation. And again, drew on things from the Quran and drew on some of the hadiths and Sharia law and this kind of thing to lobby for change and to say, you know, this is kind of a tradition. It's a custom. It's not necessarily a cultural practice, and it doesn't have any legitimacy in that way. But I think, particularly perhaps in post-conflict situations, where people feel perhaps that, you know, if there's been an invasion or something and they really feel like their, you know, way of life or their tradition or their history has been threatened, I think that you're absolutely right in saying that women tend to, you know, almost be the bearers of culture, and they're what people perceive as to kind of embody their local culture. And in that sense, you can often find that, as indeed in, you know, as you say, in Iraq and particularly in Afghanistan, that it almost goes backwards for women and they find themselves in a very oppressive situation. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
I was just going to say, this is taking us really nicely into the sort of the local, global sort of discussion. So if you can continue in that vein, bearing in mind questions about how do we then, as academics and practitioners, use these local examples, engage with these local examples, but also use the global framework. How do those sorts of possibilities, but also tensions, come across in the sorts of work?
This is a tension, particularly, generally, I think, and it's not just confined to the context of women, because inevitably international treaties about whatever are drafted at an extremely, tend to be at quite a general level, and they rely on local translation. I mean, that's just the, if you look at, some of the environmental treaties and so on. Some obviously more specific. So when you look at the Law of the Sea Convention, you get quite specific rules about, you know, international baselines and things like that, but it's always going to be an issue in the international human rights arena. And you, I mean, there's considerable room, I think, within the bounds of what's acceptable in human rights law to offer local translations of particular rights. We see enormous variation between countries, even countries that have superficial similarity. But I think that generally what I've observed, and I'm really keen to hear Catherine and Gita's views on this too. I mean, my observation in you know, my very limited knowledge of these countries in the Pacific is that women typically look at the international standards as tremendously important. And if you go in and sort of say, well, look, I know these standards are very general and I know they're problems, often women's groups will say, we're not interested in hearing that. We just think they've been incredibly valuable in trying to pressure government. And I was really struck by that last year. I was involved with some others from around the Pacific doing a mock CEDAW training in Vanuatu. And Vanuatu was going to present its first report to CEDAW, and so they, the Australian Aid Agency had organised for people from around the Pacific, different lawyers, to come in and be members of the CEDAW committee for this occasion. And I was really struck by speaking to various women's groups there how incredibly important, and it was quite effective, because the government also came along for these sessions and they were clearly very interested in what they'd have to do. It was quite interesting to see that they were concerned about the type of conversation they'd have with the treaty bodies in New York, and were trying to put some reforms in place, not always very successfully, but this was quite a powerful tool. So although they're fairly easy to critique the standards, but I think that they can have a very real effect at the local level. But both Gita and Catherine have much more local experience, so
I would certainly agree with that. I think it not only provides solidarity, I think, across, you know, a kind of global women's movement, which is really, really important, but I think it gives absolutely an international basis, and it gives a lot of room for kind of that diplomatic pressure. I mean, Afghanistan signed up to CEDAW in 2003, which meant their constitution had to guarantee equal rights with women, and these are the tools that the local women's movement is using. I think that's absolutely right. I think they have to be very careful how they use it, and I think a lot of the time it's more about the kind of approach of how they work with communities. So, and I think this is where the local civil society and the local NGOs are so well placed to go into communities where they've got this situation of trust. They might have to go through the local religious leaders to gain access to people and communities. You know, some of our partners who are doing the work will hold their first workshops in a very open space, so that, you know, men and women can both hear, so to kind of get rid of that suspicion. They'll go through the leaders first, they'll do it in mosques, and they'll use these kind of local approaches to do kind of human rights training in a local context. But certainly they're drawing on these international instruments that offers, you know, everything they do quite a lot of legitimacy, and also puts a lot of international pressure on the governments to make sure they implement what they've signed up to. Would you agree with that, Gita?
Yes, no, I mean, it's obviously foundational for us, but I think the more we did work on women's human rights, the more we realised how the cultural relativist argument really doesn't work. On the other hand, there are tensions in the way in which international organisations may plan their strategies and so on, and in the way local ones may do. And I think by and large, where we've been successful, I think our teams that work on specific countries have been very, very careful to have, you know, quite a lot of contact with local organizations to see what it is that we can offer. I mean, do we, you know, we might produce a report which is on exactly the same subject that they've been working on, so that it gives visibility to the organizations on the ground that wouldn't get meetings with their ministries or something like that, whereas if Amnesty's, you know, producing the report and saying these are our local partners, and you know, it opens doors that they wouldn't be able to open by themselves sometimes. In other cases, it's where they're, you know, really very active civil societies, it may be that we produce work which would fall in the gaps otherwise. For instance, we might do work on, we've done a little bit of work on women in prisons, for instance, where in Brazil we've done a report recently, which is based on a long period of public security work that the Brazil team had been doing, looking at both state violations but also looking at the issue of gang violence. And a lot of the contacts they had were women who were struggling, usually because their men had been killed or in jail or something like that. And they then decided to focus on the women and look at the particular ways in which women were targeted as human rights defenders and as women working in the favelas. And the most of the Brazilian women's movement wasn't doing that kind of work. It was doing excellent work, pushing for domestic violence legislation and so on, but it wasn't working within these communities, and it wasn't working on policing issues and prison issues. So it was a very useful bridge between, you know, the more traditional human rights community that works on state violations and egregious state violence against men, but doesn't work on women, and women who work on domestic violence but don't work on women facing police violence or women whose partners are facing or sons are facing police violence. But it brought those two sets of issues together. So I think it's finding those gaps. But that's a strategic issue rather than a legal issue and a rights issue. I think there are rights issues as well. And I'd like to return to some of the things that you raised, Catherine, around the FGM debate, because I've had fascinating discussions with women about that. And I think there is a lot of soul-searching in many parts of Africa where there's really been a big push on FGM. And I think it depends how it's been done and who's done it. And I think local organizations may work really well where the same issues get translated and rolled out as an international policy, they become a disaster. So for instance, some of the things that you've described in terms of working, I mean, it's a practical reality on the ground that you have to engage with the power structures. Whether you identify them as religious or feudal, political or whatever they are. Our Pakistan researcher, who has had a very, he is Pakistani himself, and he's had a very, very long track record working not only with civil rights organizations, which he has done in Pakistan, but with feminist organizations, and is a leading writer and thinker around honor crimes and these sort of issues. Is very critical of some of the, and he's worked in Afghanistan as well. He's worked with Afghanistan women in Afghanistan, trying to lobby around the constitution and so on, particularly to try and ensure that, you know, such language as there was around Islamic law and so on would remain at a very general level of, you know, aspirational language that we think these laws should be compatible with Islam, which at least it's potentially dangerous, but it leaves space to argue about, you know, what kind of Islam it's compatible with if you also have commitments to equality and non-discrimination and so on within the constitution. So, you know, I think what people in international organizations sometimes forget is that these are long political processes and they can't actually be they can't be foreshortened, which is not to say that the international community shouldn't help. Getting the language in place is enormously important, but it's just one step in a very long battle. And the implementation, in the end, is part of the political process within the country, which has to be fought for. I mean, it is a hearts and minds struggle. It is a power struggle within the country. And it can't simply be done through donors deciding they're going to do something. And in fact, donors have not proved very good partners, I think. And I'm sorry to talk so long, but I do want to make this point about the local, which is this one issue around FGM, where women in a network called SIHA, which is Strategic Initiatives for Women in the Horn of Africa, they're an extraordinary network. 1325 is a very important part of their work. But precisely what they want to do is look at why equality frameworks are not being used to argue for women's rights, and why the issue of equality is entirely marginalized in donor agendas and therefore sometimes in women advocates' own agendas. I mean, so that really, you know, they are facing, as we know in the Horn of Africa, is facing active conflicts in so many parts of the Horn, and their intellectual discussion among women who are coming from the heart of conflicts is why are we not arguing for equality, you know? And how do we argue for equality? Because it's not, they're not sitting there moaning, they're trying to find mechanisms by which, you know, they're not using vulnerability arguments but equality arguments. They're very critical of their own experiences of the FGM, around the FGM issue, particularly the use of Islamicizing the issue, as it were. It's of course true, it's not, you know, it's not sanctioned formally, you know, within the sort of, well, in the Quran or Hadith and so on. But that doesn't mean that religious leaders haven't used it at various points and processes. But I think the key issue that they identify, and which my colleague Sohail Varaichu, as I said, is a leading male feminist from Pakistan, would say, is that religious leaders don't actually have much to do with many issues of civil society, and that quite often it's the feudal leaders who may be the more powerful ones. The clan leaders, depending on the country you're in, the chiefs or whoever, they may not be the religious leaders. And the donors have assumed a kind of pastoral role for the religious leaders, actually very much on the model of the Christian church, which they have then rolled out in numerous policies where they've done workshops with religious leaders and things. I think there's a fundamental difference between that kind of workshop and what women do in their personal negotiations on the ground. But they've actually promoted a role for religion which didn't exist in traditional society, and actually in a violation like FGM, which is a violation committed largely by women on other women and girls, where it's the leaderships within the women's, the communities of women and the power structures among women that are important. And religious leaders have absolutely no influence on that. And by and large, they see in their own communities that those methods have failed. So they're doing a self-critique of what happened. And what happened with one of the key critiques they made of the failure is that the argument shifted from an equality argument, or as a leading Egyptian reproductive rights campaigner, Dr. Fatala, who's worked with Rebecca Cook, Professor Rebecca Cook, on reproductive rights issues, said, as he frames it, it's not he also talks about the failure of the international community in using health arguments as a doctor. He says the fundamental issue is the issue of the dignity of women, in other words, the autonomy of women. However you frame it, you can frame that in ways that are acceptable in a society. You don't need to frame it, there are ways where you may frame it differently. You may frame it overtly as a question of sexual rights, which I think it is. You may not use that language, but you may use many of the concepts that are associated with it, which I think are well understood by women in all kinds of situations. So he critiques it from the health angle, where the instrumental health argument only in Egypt led to the medicalization of the practice. And in Somaliland, women are critiquing it from the argument where they said that, you know, putting it in the hands of a mullah meant that he would say, don't do this version of FGM, do that version of FGM. So it shifts completely away from equality to doing a lesser, a smaller incision, or, don't do infibulation or something like this.
Just on the issue of equality, though, there are some writers who say, the reason why equality arguments don't work in these international and local campaigns is because that it will often have very little purchase in a particular society. I don't know what you both think about that. I imagine that as an objection to what I was saying last night, which is to say, let's focus on the equality ones. And one of my colleagues at the ANU, Sharon Bessel, she's actually written an article where she says, "Oh, people who advocate, taking the equality line are really just barking up the wrong tree because it's completely unstrategic." But the other thing, just in the context of East Timor, I mean, one issue with relationship between the international and the local is the fact that when something is labelled as an international standard, at least in that context, it was quite easily ridiculed by particular male leaders. So, who said, and this was actually a speech that Jeanne Guzmao made, whose wife is a feminist and who's, meant to have, many of these sympathies, but here she made this sort of quite important speech before Timor-Leste became independent, where he said to the East Timorese, please be very careful about swallowing all these international standards. We must really be proud of East Timorese culture. Don't be so hungry for importation of standards. And this was a you know, quite a crucial moment where he really rallied people to be quite cautious about, you know, accepting international standards. Well, I don't understand enough about the background politics, but it was a speech he made on New Year's Eve and to a major rally, and he said what really disturbed him, and he had enormous stature as the guerrilla leader, and he said, I think that the East Timorese are so hungry for values after this period of international occupation that they're willing to sort of take the first set of values that have come in the door, and these happen to be those of the UN, and I think you should be very cautious about adopting these. And it was read in the context very much of scepticism about women's rights. But so that is one problem. But just going back to the other question, I mean, why is the idea of equality such a hard sell? What do you think in societies, you know?
Can I just jump in really quickly here, because this leads us on really nicely, I think, to the differing roles or the complementary roles between the academics, practitioners, activists, in terms of the ways in which we're using these sorts of concepts, we're using the framework of international law. So if you can reflect on that as well in your answers. Thank you.
Well, yeah, I think that relates quite well to your question, Hilary, because I think academia, you know, plays a great role in kind of highlighting patriarchy and highlighting gender roles, and I think that is the situation for a lot of these women, is that they're operating in an extremely patriarchal environment, and I think that's extremely challenging. And I think whilst I would say that most of the women's NGOs that I've worked with definitely would have, you know, agreed with the equality argument, and that's totally what they're going for, I think you're looking at entry points, and I think it's a very dangerous environment for a lot of these women's rights activists, particularly in some of these places where there's a lack of rule of law. And I think, again, I mean, maybe the health argument isn't really what we should be going for. And I think as well, in your lecture last night, you showed that we really must be careful to make sure we don't kind of get co-opted by some of this language. But you know, they have got to start somewhere, and I think if they go kind of, you know, feminist flags waving into some of these very conservative environments where, you know, some of the women themselves, for example, you know, totally swallow the kind of the arguments that are given patriarchally, I think it can be very, very dangerous. You know, a lot of the women's rights activists are in a very precarious situation. A lot of them are being murdered quite regularly, and I think it's just that pragmatism, basically. But I think that's coming back to the question. I think that's where international organisations can play quite a helpful role, because whilst the women's movements and why some of the NGOs in the countries concerned are kind of, you know, having to be very pragmatic and perhaps, you know, making strides where they can in some of these local communities just to make life better for the women and girls involved, whether that's access to education or stopping forced and early marriages and some of these, you know, very practical steps that they need to take. International organisations, you know, such as Womankind worldwide, such as Amnesty, can be a lot more vocal. And what we do in terms of hooking up the local and the global is that we will get together with our partners and we will together form advocacy plans and decide what issues we want to take forward. Whereas they might do it at a very local level, we use the international frameworks and we're able to go to international policymakers and donors and push for better resources and push for diplomatic pressure. And media as well is the other thing we have a lot of access to, as indeed does Amnesty, to really make these things at the top of the international agenda. And to make sure that governments are kind of, you know, living up to what they've promised. And I think that's one very complementary way. And the fact is also what you said, you know, is that international organisations often have access to decision makers and the doors open, which the local civil society simply doesn't have. And I think that's where, as long as you can make sure you're kind of both centred around the same aims, I think that's where the two can marry really, really well together.
I think the academic work that would really help, I think the equality is a hard sell because it's a revolutionary idea. I think that's the bottom line. I don't think I know what equality means. If somebody would tell me, I don't think any of us live in a society in which there is absolute equality. I don't think we can begin to understand it, really. I think it is utopian in some ways. So we really need to begin to imagine some of these possibilities, because equality is surely not just an absence of harm, you know, or an absence of discrimination. And even discrimination, we're trying to still tease out, you know, what constitutes discrimination. And you know, I mean, you know far better than I do, there's been, you know, a huge number of, huge literature on equality. Last night, a woman mentioned the you know, arguments about equity and equality that, among other places, took place in Beijing, and those still rage. So I think there's that issue, and I think that's something that, that we can be helped with. And I think, you know, the work that you did with Christine Chinkin on the boundaries of international law is foundational for us as a text, and Professor Cook's work on reproductive rights issues. I mean, she has a very challenging article that she wrote with somebody else in the Emory Law Journal on which is called Accommodating Women's Differences in CEDAW and the Women's Anti-Discrimination Convention. But what she's arguing about is an idea of equality. I mean, looking at the issue of abortion, how it would play out through, you know, a CEDAW-based argument. And it's really, it's a wonderful piece of work, and it's very challenging. So I think those are, you know, sort of key pieces of thinking that, that do help us as practitioners in working these things out. But one of the things, you know, that's at the academic level, and the other is, you know, as I said, the kind of thinking that CEHA's engaging with, where it's actually talking to its own, you know, it's a network itself, so talking to its network as members about why women's rights continue to be marginalized and how do we construct arguments for equality. And it is interesting to me that it's not that they would rush ahead and take on a whole lot of issues which would immediately get all of them, you know, thrown in jail. So the specific issues on which they campaign, you know, may be very, very specific, you know, exactly things like forced marriage, FGM has been a major issue that they've all worked on, 1325, women's representation in politics, where again they were pushed back, you know, they've tried very hard, not got very far, so they were trying to consider what to do about that, and of course, I think came to the conclusion that it is an important issue that they will continue to work on, but it's not just getting the numbers into Parliament, it's what are the political debates you use that movement to raise about, you know, what are you going to do with the representation, you know, what are men going to do, what are their duties in Parliament towards women's rights and so on. So it's understanding it's not just a numbers game about quotas, because they're not going to succeed on the quotas.
Hilary, do you have any thoughts about the academic activist relationship?
It's a complicated one, I think, and it's very heartening to hear, you know, if I think as an academic, as you are, Zoe, I don't know if you share these feelings, but you often feel that what you write is, you're often surprised if people have read it. I actually usually always send a copy of something I write to my parents, and they've recently moved house, and I discovered when I went down to help them move that clearly anything that their children had sent them was getting put in a box and kept under the house. So I realised that I only thought perhaps my parents read this stuff, so it's good if it goes a bit further. But I'm constantly, I suppose I feel that I'm sometimes embarrassed as an academic to be writing on some issues when I have so little practical experience. And I think, well, the way my life has panned out with, you know, needing to care for children and being very sort of close to home, I think an academic life has actually suited me well because I've had sort of control, much more control over my life. But I'm very conscious because of that sort of choice that sometimes when I write, I think, oh, I'm about to be blown out of the water by somebody who's actually worked in this area and will say, you've got it just so wrong, you couldn't have got it more wrong. So I always feel sort of quite anxious about a lot of my writing, that it's based much more on ideas than actually going into the field. And this research I've been doing in peace building, my co-worker John Braithwaite, who's a field worker from way back, and he usually goes out, he'll spend sort of 3 months in a place, and I can never do that. I go in for a very short period and try and speak to as many people as I can. But I think that as an academic, I often feel quite, well, inadequate, I think, in the face of activism, and sort of think, well, this is a whole experience that I don't know very much about, and I do see myself often in sort of an ivory tower, having the occasional idea and wondering what might become of it. So and then of course some people manage to combine both roles very, very effectively, but I think of myself as somebody with quite limited experience, and so it's something, yes, of a real, I think, of a weakness in what I do and what I write.
But you engage with policy issues, don't you? Because you've engaged with some of the 1325 debates in Australia.
Yes, I do, but I'm conscious that's, again, I see that as very easy work. I actually live in Canberra, and it's so you can front up to Parliament House and speak to a few parliamentarians, and that doesn't seem, you know, the sort of the frontline activism that I see other people doing. So I keep thinking, well, when the children have left home, perhaps I'll sort of turn into this. But then you realise, well, you just don't have the skills, because when you watch sort of and observe how activists sort of operate, you realise, oh, well, I just don't have any of those skills. I'd be far too impatient. I get really angry. I do something quite undiplomatic. And so it's something that I see as, a real gap. And if I could go and live my life again, I'd probably try and do it quite differently, I think. So.
Oh, that's quite interesting, because having spent a lot of time in the NGO field, but also having studied academically, I think academia's got a definite role to play in all this. And I think, you know, some of the work that's been done around conflict dynamics, whether that's across regions, of the causes of conflict, and particularly in picking out kind of gender issues relating to things like violent masculinities, and, you know, it's really unpicking some of the fundamental causes of violence. I think the only thing is that there needs to be more contact between the two, because certainly I've always got a lot out of it when I've had the chance to study academically, and particularly feminist theory around some of this, some of these debates, I think are absolutely fundamental actually to a lot of the work that's going on. How you translate that for the women on the ground, I think, is something challenging. But I think you've got to keep your eye on some of the systems that are in place and some of these, you know, fundamental causes. And particularly, you know, looking at some of the gender issues and how that totally defines conflict. It's probably the fundamental reason why men go to war, why some of the, you know, to protect the women staying at home, because they feel they ought to, because that's how masculinity is defined and this kind of thing. And I actually think that until you really get to the root of some of this stuff, you know, you're not going to necessarily unpack the fundamental constructs behind some of the causes of conflict, and particularly, you know, when you're looking at how some of conflict manifests itself, again, from what you were saying on earlier, Geeta, about, you know, how unless you do have an academic perspective on how something, you know, like state conflict can, you know, really kind of dissolve into, or almost be suppressed into, you know, something like domestic violence, you need that. I think you really need that perspective. So yes, I mean, the more we can kind of get together, I think, and debate, and the more, you know, activists have access to some of the feminist thinking, and particularly through, I think, lectures and talks and conversations like these, I think it's absolutely crucial. I really do.
There's one area that I think is really important to understand, where I think academic work could have a profound effect. I don't think we've really got there in terms of understanding it or being able to apply it within a kind of framework of analysing human rights violations, is particularly, as you said, Catherine, in conflict with the connections between, sort of gender, nation, the intersection of different forms of community or ethnic identity, race identity, sort of being able to analyse the drive of the politics of identity without actually falling into a form of identity politics analytically, which I think, you know, some academic writing sometimes does do. And so I've been very influenced by a lot of scholar activists who work around these issues, like Neera Yuval Davis, who I've worked with. On this, and Cynthia Colburn, who's looked at a lot of work on women in politics, and both of them have worked with ideas of transversal politics and you know, being able to see the other's point of view and being able to meet halfway and so on, which has helped in many of the situations where women at different sides of different conflicts have been able to create spaces where they can talk to each other. I think that's all very important, but it's also important in the understanding of genocide and you know, the most grave crimes in international law. And I think most international lawyers and most human rights investigators don't see the issues as sharply as they've been seen still in the academic field, and yet we can't understand why these things happen. So we still use often, I think, in various issues analysing international conflicts, you hear the language of, there is the language of fragile states and fragile societies, which, and of course it's used politically in various ways, some of which are quite dangerous. But apart from that political use, which I leave to one side for the moment, there's also a sense of, you know, embedded conflicts, people who've, you know, are always at each other's throats, you know, tribal wars, that kind of thing, which completely ignores the analytical thinking that might actually lead to some kind of understanding of what's going on. And for me, understanding that means that we have to understand that massive violence is what is used, not because a society is fragile, but in order to create the other as an enemy, to create your neighbor or your husband or your child or your cousin as the other suddenly. You have to have massive violence, an ideology of violence that drives them apart. You know, that is how Jews who are the, you know, more assimilated in Germany, you know, with more legal rights than many other European states, you know, the Holocaust wasn't a natural outcome. We don't talk of it as a sort of tribal outburst, but it happened because Nazi ideologies clearly stated and evoked a situation where people were created as an enemy to be destroyed. And I think, you know, that happened in Rwanda, it's happening in many other places. On a far smaller scale, it happened with the Hindu right in India against Muslims and also against Christians. It's been less well known. And I think that is absolutely crucial. And there was a women's report done on Gujarat, which we cited in our work on Gujarat in Amnesty International, an international commission of women, which included women who've worked on conflict in these ways. So Rhonda Copeland, Neera Yuval Davis, Sunila Abhisekara, who's worked on these issues both as an advocate and human rights defender in Sri Lanka, Anissa Eli Lucas, who's worked in women in, living under Muslim laws in Algeria. It was Indian women actually organized to bring women from abroad who were scholars and activists in order to analyze what had happened, to do a fact-finding mission. But more than facts, because they'd done a lot of documentation already, they wanted the analytical framework on why this conflict happened, and they wanted it also analyzed within a feminist legal framework on as a crime against humanity. Mm-hmm. And also as a form of genocidal violence.
I think you have highlighted very strongly the real need for us to keep having these sorts of conversations. It's been a very rich very productive and very challenging conversation, I think. And I thank you all very much for your comments. Harriet, have we got time for a couple of other questions?
I think maybe one or questions, just very quick, I think. Yeah. Time's running.
Well, it's my turn to ask a quick question.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, yes, sorry, it's Emma McLean from the University of Westminster. It's not actually my question, but I fully agree with it. It's one of my colleagues' questions, and you'll soon understand when I ask it, because it is about Northern Ireland. Is women's contribution to peace building tailored differently in developing states compared to developed states? And here the example was given was Timor-Leste and Northern Ireland. And speaking from my own personal experience, the Women's Coalition in Northern Ireland were crucial to arriving at the Belfast Agreement. Thereafter, they disappeared from the political landscape. They are no longer a political party. So is it different?
Well, that has very depressing similarity, I think, to all the cases that I know, certainly Timor-Leste, Bougainville, Solomon Islands, you have exactly the same thing happening. And this really makes me think, I actually hadn't realised that about Northern Ireland. So, because often that's held up as a great example of women's involvement, a really successful one. And what seems to happen as soon as you find a successful example, you look underneath a bit and you see the story is not quite so splendid. So what is happening? I mean, Sari Kuvo asked that question last night and I've been thinking about it again. I mean, what happens, women being very instrumental, and you said that too, Geeta, you know, this we actually do see women being tremendously influential in conflict situations, in bringing people together, and yet, you know, then their absolute disappearance from the political scene. And perhaps that makes me think there must be some moment, some opportunity of intervention that we're not taking full advantage of. And when I say we, I mean, I'm thinking of people from an international perspective who might be involved, that perhaps this is something that really needs further study, this moment when you've got, yes, you finally push people to a peace table, you might even have a seat or two at the peace table, and then women just sort of are shuffled off the scene, and it's people are very anxious to have business as usual, and we didn't have women in the old days, and why should we have them now? But this is a moment that obviously needs a lot of attention from academics and from NGOs to try and analyse much more closely when that slippage occurs. Women in Bougainville, when I spoke to them, would talk of how, you know, they were really felt they had a lot of status, and as I said last night, that their, you know, some of the matrilineal traditions were being revived, which they found extremely encouraging. And then it was really once the peace agreement had been signed, it was, well, thank you, and please go back to the village. But that's the moment that I think needs a lot more unravelling.
Well, I think the international donor community has got a huge role to play in this, I have to say, because, you know, it tends to be in these kind of post-conflict situations where you do get a lot of resources coming in and a lot of international involvement in some of these countries. And I think until women's rights are at the top of, you know, top of the agenda for some of the donor governments and some of the more influential governments, I think that's when it drops off the agenda, and I think that's really worrying.
Is there a possibility, though, do you think, of change there?
Well, I think this is what a lot of the kind of more, you know, the international groups are doing, you know, Womankind's involved in a variety of networks, and here in the UK and spend a lot of our time advocating at the UK, the EU and even the UN level for increased resources. But you always find things from, you know, not only are the women's organisations very under-resourced, so are the relevant ministries of women's affairs, for example, that get set up, are very, very under-resourced, you know, and even in kind of peacekeeping missions and things like that, you just don't see the women's representation, you don't see the resources going into pre-deployment gender training. And I think resources is one of the really critical factors, and it's got to be highlighted in donor policy, and I would say still the major donors do not see gender equality and gender concerns as being at top of the international top of the agenda. I think it's much more focused on economics and much more focused on economics probably, and things like counter-narcotics and these kind of things. So I think that might be when it drops off, is when the resources really need to go in to help this women's movement keep this massive momentum that they tend to get during the peace process. And again, yeah, business as usual, you know, let's worry about women's issues later, let's first get the economy going and let's get, you know, all these kind of things done. So I think until we can make sure it's totally mainstream and it's seen as a massive, people understand how important it is, I think that's massive.
I think it's also the political, I think it is universal, pretty much. I mean, Rwanda has 50% representation of women in parliament. I don't know how much of a voice they've been able to develop in terms of actually pressing demands that maybe the government might not want and so on, but at least they're there. But, you know, I think these processes take a very, very long time. I mean, India's had many areas of conflict, but you know, as a central state, the entire state isn't in conflict. And it's only very recently that power has been dissolved in India from central government to village level government, so they elected village assemblies. They have a lot of problems, their village councils, but they have budgets now to control, and they have women's representation in them, which have control over money for the first time. Well. So it's working pretty well. I mean, there's going to be a lot of political contestation, there's going to be a lot of caste contestation and so on, and it's not going to be an easy process. But I think the fantasy is that the post-conflict societies are tabula rasas. They're not blank slates that either we as human rights, either the good guys, as it were, all of us with good intentions, as human rights advocates or women's advocates or donor governments, can write on. I think there are long political processes. I think that goes back to the Timor-Leste example that you mentioned, where I think there's a natural feeling which where the suspicion of international law may be, and quite often is, about undermining women's rights or specific civil rights of various kinds, but it may also be an idea that we can construct these things for ourselves and we can come up with something that's just as good. And I think if it is just as good, it will closely align with international instruments, and of course that's what Amnesty International would be advocating for. But I think sometimes international organizations, I think we have been much more careful in recent times to refer not just to international law, but where constitutions have the same provisions or similar provisions, to refer to the jurisprudence of countries, the national jurisprudence and constitutional jurisprudence, in order to find laws that judges can relate to, for instance. I mean, it's many lawyers don't relate to international law very well. I think that is one of our problems with implementation. It's not just that governments don't want to implement them. Actually, in the courts, lawyers don't refer to international instruments very much. So part of the work that international organizations do, of course, is to try and I'm sure you've been involved with this kind of work at various times, although you've been extremely modest about the kind of work you do. I'm sure that there have been those kinds of involvements that at various times academics and other lawyers have done trainings and so on with judges and practicing lawyers in the courts in order to get them to cite and use international instruments. And in Pakistan, under very adverse circumstances, lawyers have cited CEDAW, for instance, to press their point about women's equality rights in relation to honor killings, which are excused under Pakistani law in various ways.
Thank you. Just a very brief final question from Talia.
Okay, well, yes, I'll go there. Yes, thank you very much for the conversation, and I would like to pick Geeta up on the point you made about sort of the massive violence really being necessary in order to create the enemy. I thought that was a very interesting argument, because I'm looking at issues in my own work surrounding the conflict in Yugoslavia and how ethnicity was actually created through the conflict and wasn't really there before so much. And I wonder whether perhaps NGOs have slightly, in this whole debate in which it was very important to visualize and to publicize crimes, sexual crimes against women in particular, through the workings of international criminal tribunals and so forth, whether it hasn't been somewhat of a very one-sided debate in which it was very important sort of to get the message out that, for example, Bosnian Muslim women were very victimized and were subject to huge atrocities, but then other women, which also might have been subjected to atrocities and war crimes, were marginalized as a result of this, of getting it, getting the message out there, getting the story out there that, women were victims, but then only one kind of category of women were victims, and that was very dependent on ethnicity as well, and that perhaps it just feels to me that there's not too much work going on in that area in terms of analyzing how ethnicity intersects with gender and how perhaps ethnicity sometimes is also a stumbling board in terms of really getting the message out that it is a crime against women primarily and that it shouldn't be dependent on ethnicity.
It shouldn't, but it is also a crime against women of particular communities by others, So and quite often in conflicts, each community is responsible for those. It's not always completely even, though. I mean, I don't think a numbers game justifies. I mean, a crime against one woman is not justified. The forces in some conflicts are sometimes grossly unequal. Sometimes they're not. In the Bangladesh conflict, there wasn't a force that was. There were atrocities committed by fighters on who fought for the side of Bangladesh, as it were, against civilians. But the level and the scale and the systematic nature of them was
it just wasn't comparable. There was a massive organized army on one side, and you know, we may not have the proof, but it's certainly generally believed that the level of the violence would argue a level of systematic violence. You know, it wasn't just a set of random acts. And I think in the case of former Yugoslavia, it is one of the things that's very difficult to prove in a court of law, because we don't have necessarily, you know, papers with chains of command showing orders being given to actually commit violence of that nature. I think those things are important. I think it is important to acknowledge that different sides face atrocities. I think those discussions have taken place in very difficult situations, for instance, between Palestinian and Israeli women. But I think it is important in many of those to also acknowledge that the sides are not equal in some cases. So it is both. I mean, it's you know, we have to hold three or four almost mutually exclusive concepts in our head at the same time and try and align them. And I think we have to do this as academics, and we have to do this as practitioners, that yes, it is a crime against women, and it's a crime against women's bodies, but it's also a crime that, you know, there was a feminist debate against using rape as a crime of honor and a crime of shaming the community. And really, some of the feminist analysis now shows that actually it's both at the same time, because rapes are used instrumentally against the community as well as against the women. So it's both simultaneously. And I think we have to recognize that, and that there is pain in a conflict on and harm to all sides of it.
As per usual, I've been a very hopeless chair in keeping to time. But that's because the conversation has been so interesting. I want to thank you all very much for your participation and your commitment to this conversation. It's been very productive, very challenging, many ways in which we can go forward. And I hope that these sorts of conversations can continue, because I think it has highlighted how very important they are and how very useful it will be for feminist engagement in international.
Thank you.
Thank you.